His dreams would carry him beyond the small cloistered world of a biblical scholar. Over time, the immoderate Harper gave liberal interpretations to Rockefeller's vague promises of money, but he never misrepresented the scope of his plans. Even before accepting the presidency, he boasted to Rockefeller, "I believe that 10 years will show an institution at Chicago which will amaze the multitudes." Working 16-hour days, Harper now negotiated more than 120 faculty appointments in little more than a year. Rockefeller might think the university a plant of slow growth, but Harper wanted it to bloom overnight. The new president raided so many Ivy League faculties, the ranks of Yale and Cornell were especially depleted, that his ransacked rivals complained of foul play. Harper dangled sizable sums before reluctant prospects, enlarging the school's future financial requirements. This nationwide talent search netted 9 college presidents for the first faculty. Harper signed up John Dewey and George Herbert Mead for the philosophy department, and enticed novelist Robert Herrick to join the English department, while Albion Small initiated America's first graduate department in sociology. Another eminent recruit, economist Thorsten Veblen, came to regard Harper as the educational counterpart of capitalists such as Rockefeller, and satirized him as a captain of erudition, one of a new species of empire builders in higher education. However inspired he was by Harper, Rockefeller felt sorely beset by his extravagant spending, and their relations began to fray. With outside fundraising stalled, it seemed that Rockefeller's worst nightmare was coming true. He would end up sole benefactor of an institution that would bleed him dry for years. Whenever they met, they stayed away from money talk and spoke of educational policy. Financial matters were shunted off into increasingly testy private exchanges between Gates and Harper, exchanges that Rockefeller reviewed privately. By the spring of 1891, Rockefeller began to develop the queasy sense that Harper regarded his money as a blank check to cover annual deficits. To their surprise and disbelief, Rockefeller and Gates saw that the new president would not drop his busy lecture schedule, which netted him $4,000 a year, and contemplated a $3,000 offer to head the Chautauqua School of the English Bible, while also planning a fancy European trip, all the while banking a handsome $10,000 salary at the University of Chicago. As Rockefeller fumed in the summer of 1891, Gates met with Harper and urged him to shed his outside activities. Of course, he rejected these proposals, Gates informed Rockefeller, as well as the intimation contained in it that his motives are not without their mercenary side. It was an odd situation, the world's richest man chastising a biblical scholar for unseemly materialism. To some extent, Rockefeller sent out conflicting messages and was partly to blame for Harper's profligacy. It was Rockefeller, after all, who urged Harper to pay top dollar for America's best academic minds. As Gates told Harper after one meeting with Rockefeller, "We talked at great length about salaries of head professors, pro and con, and as a result he wished me to say to you positively that the best men must be had." Such talk could easily inspire a cavalier attitude toward money. Gates also had an ulterior motive for wishing Harper away from the lecture circuit. Though he was not the freethinker darkly portrayed by Dr. Strong, Harper did have heterodox religious views and brooded morbidly on his own heresy. Practicing the higher criticism, he had moved away from a stress on biblical inerrancy to a scholarly search for the authorship of sacred texts. Though becoming a modernist in his own right, Gates wanted Harper to muzzle his unorthodox views in public. Potential donors were already worried about the new university's diluted baptism and questioned Harper's doctrinal purity. To one such critic, Gates insisted, "Dr. Harper is a man of evangelistic spirit and annually secures scores of conversions at Yale," implying that he would continue this practice at Chicago. When Gates expressed concern to Harper about his views, the latter made a clean breast of his liberal religious views to Rockefeller so that he would never be shocked by his unorthodoxy. The newspapers were not privy to these internal tensions and lampooned the implausible pairing of the Trust King and the biblical scholar. Harper was irritated by cartoons that showed him sprinting after Rockefeller and his money bags. In one cartoon strip, Harper desperately pursued Rockefeller across a frozen Hudson River, hopping from one ice floe to the next, until a weary Rockefeller dropped a thick wad of bills behind him to sate the university president. When Rockefeller later gave $1 million to Yale, another cartoonist drew Harper astride a college building marked University of Chicago, glaring enviously at another college building marked Yale. Harper was often portrayed as a sycophant of the rich. In one cartoon, he was seen greeting fashionable ladies at the train station and carrying their luggage, which was marked Proper Function of College Presidents. There must have been moments in 1891 when John D. Rockefeller wondered how he had gotten entangled in a project so vast and headed by such a brilliantly erratic man. Had he known what lay ahead, it seems doubtful that he would have persevered. But he had now publicly staked his reputation on this hugely expensive endeavor, and in the last analysis, wherever William Rainey Harper led, John D. Rockefeller would grudgingly follow. He was not a man to abandon a project that had received his blessing. However mingled with joy, Rockefeller's anguish over the University of Chicago came at a moment of physical vulnerability and tipped him over the edge toward a breakdown. Gates's letters to Harper are laced with references to their patron's sharply deteriorating health. In April 1891, Gates said after a tete-a-tete with Rockefeller, "He was kindness itself, but appeared very sad and depressed. He even told me that anxiety and worry about the matter, i.e. university finances, had made him sick, and it was this that took him from his business and drove him to Cleveland. We must not press him for money. Let us see to it, and see if we cannot cut down expenses and get through the first year with the smallest possible deficit." This was more than mere bluff or tactical posturing on Gates's part, though there was doubtless some of that. Starting in early 1889, Rockefeller had complained continually of fatigue and depression. For several decades, he had expended superhuman energy in the creation of Standard Oil, mastering myriad details. All the while, pressure had built steadily beneath the surface repose. One could now see in his face the subdued melancholy of a man who had sacrificed too much for work. In early 1890, Rockefeller stayed away from the office for several months due to an unspecified illness. Later in the year, he promised to stop working on Saturdays and take more vacations, but the symptoms harried him into the following spring. By 1891, the top executive ranks were beginning to thin at Standard Oil. Charles Pratt died suddenly that year, and Henry Flagler was increasingly distracted by his Florida hotel and railway ventures. Having groomed John D. Archbold as his successor, Rockefeller began to shift day-to-day power to his feisty bantam protégé. More reviled than honored for his triumphs, Rockefeller, 52, felt embattled by endless subpoenas from court cases and congressional hearings. Though he brushed off his critics as minor irritants and professed faith in his own integrity, it could not have been easy to face such universal opprobrium. Keeping up the pose of indifference must have taken its own toll. Nevertheless, Rockefeller had come through earlier assaults unscathed. What really disturbed him was not so much making money, but spending it. One Cleveland society woman, a friend, told a story of sitting beside him on a streetcar when the conductor came to collect fares. When Rockefeller handed him a quarter, the conductor deducted 2 nickel fares, assuming he would pay for the lady, and gave him 15 cents change. "My change is 5 cents short," Rockefeller declared. "Why, no, I took out 2 fares and gave you back 15 cents, explained the conductor. "But I did not tell you to take out 2 fares, Rockefeller retorted. "Let this be a lesson to you, and never assume that a passenger is paying for 2 people unless he says so." Rockefeller reviewed every bill that arrived at home and often patrolled the hallways, turning off gas lights. Such habits were not simply reflexive stinginess, but were rooted in bedrock beliefs about the value of money. when he discovered that one railroad overcharged him $117 for carrying his family and horses, he had the Standard Oil treasurer immediately retrieve the money. "I need the $117 to build mission churches in the West," he explained, showing the association in his own mind between savings and charity. With such uncommon respect for the dollar, he couldn't cope with the psychological demands of the University of Chicago and other philanthropic commitments. As Rockefeller said, "I investigated and worked myself almost to a nervous breakdown in groping my way without sufficient guide or chart through the ever-widening field of philanthropic endeavor. It was forced upon me to organize and plan this department upon as distinct lines of progress as our other business affairs." The figures of Rockefeller's contributions between 1889 and 1892 reflect the expanding nature of his giving. From $124,000 in 1889, right before his big pledge to Gates, his donations soared to $304,000 in 1890, $510,000 in 1891, and then a spectacular $1.35 million in 1892, $22 million today, as he opened the spigot for the University of Chicago. Clearly, he needed someone to help with the avalanche of appeals overwhelming him, and by late 1889, he began to forward begging letters to Frederick T. Gates. "I'm disposed more and more to give only through organized agencies," he told Gates. Finally, in March 1891, suffering from broken health and all too aware of his mortal limitations, Rockefeller summoned Gates for a confidential parley. "I'm in trouble, Mr. Gates. The pressure of these appeals for gifts has become too great for endurance. I haven't the time or strength, with all my heavy business responsibilities, to deal with these demands properly. I am so constituted as to be unable to give away money with any satisfaction until I have made the most careful inquiry as to the worthiness of the cause. These investigations are now taking more of my time and energy than the Standard Oil itself. Either I must shift part of the burden or stop giving entirely, and I cannot do the latter." "Indeed, you cannot, Mr. Rockefeller," Gates replied. "Well, I must have a helper. I have been watching you. I think you are the man. I want you to come to New York and open an office here. You can aid me in my benefactions by taking interviews and inquiries and reporting the results for action. What do you say?" Gates accepted, and in March 1891 transplanted his family to Montclair, New Jersey, and took up offices in the Temple Court near 26 Broadway. This action, which ended his ministerial career, made him an earthly potentate instead. At first, Gates retained his position as secretary of the ABES and funneled Rockefeller money around the country. By 1892, Gates joyously proclaimed to Rockefeller, "Our denomination has a larger, better distributed, better organized, and more efficient educational property than any other denomination in America." Only after 1900 did the two men begin to branch out into the revolutionary schemes that transformed old-fashioned denominational charity into modern philanthropy. By that point, Gates had assembled a team of advisors tutored in Rockefeller's principles, trained in his methods, and fired with his evangelical zeal. For the remainder of his life, Rockefeller's medical status provoked so much fantasy, gossip, and speculation that we should try to define it here with some precision. Rockefeller had been fit and youthful well into his 50s. He never adopted the sleek, portly look of his fellow plutocrats and seemed 10 years younger than his age. What, then, ailed him in the early 1890s? Broadly speaking, the answer was overwork, brought on by the combined stress of work and charity. As his inseparable companion and homeopathic physician, Dr. Hamilton Bigger, said, "A little more of that would have killed him. Mr. Rockefeller was close to the edge of a breakdown when he finally let himself be persuaded that he could no longer do the work of several men with the strength of one." But if overwork weakened his immune system, he also succumbed to opportunistic diseases. In 1891, a national grippe swept the nation, and Rockefeller was laid low. Dr. Bigger also diagnosed him as having a catarrh of the upper part of the bronchial tubes. For years, Rockefeller suffered from liver trouble. At one point, he bought a liver pad from a local drugstore, wearing it with beneficial results. And in the early 1890s, Dr. Bigger plugged him full of an unnamed brew he had concocted for this trouble. It was Rockefeller's prolonged digestive troubles that most titillated the public, providing enduring satisfaction to moralists, who believed that if Rockefeller could not be brought to justice, he could at least be tormented through his bodily afflictions. He had serious digestive problems in the early 1890s, perhaps even stress-related ulcers, and looked pale and haggard. For a time, to soothe his stomach, he lunched on milk and crackers at 26 Broadway, Spartan fare that he enjoyed and sometimes even ordered by choice. He recovered from his digestive troubles, however, and they never recurred in any really threatening way. Yet he remained extremely fussy about his food, taking small, sparing bites in a manner that spawned a thousand myths about his ruined system. For years it was bruited that he had a standing million-dollar offer for any doctor who could repair his stomach. Those who believed that Rockefeller was suffering divine retribution would have been interested to learn that in November 1888, SETI was seriously injured in an alcohol lamp explosion that badly burned both her hands and face. She had to be bedridden for several weeks. Only a few mystifying references to this ghastly accident appear in Rockefeller's letters. One can't help but wonder whether the lamp was actually burning Standard Oil kerosene, and whether Rockefeller turned it into an alcohol lamp in his correspondence. Would the wife of John D. Rockefeller have used alcohol lamps? If SETI was the casualty of impure Standard Oil kerosene, her husband might well have viewed her accident as celestial judgment upon him. During 1891, under doctor's orders, Rockefeller took time off from work and spent 8 months at Forest Hill, the family's sovereign cure for illness. His private secretary, George D. Rogers, was placed under strict instructions to spare him all but urgent business matters. For the first time in 21 years, his mind was cleansed of Standard Oil. To restore his health, he worked with his farm laborers in the field, rode his bike, ate simply, and jokingly claimed he was becoming a great concert singer. These traditional remedies worked like a charm, for by June 1891, he wrote Archbold, "I am happy to state that my health is steadily improving. I can hardly tell you how different the world begins to look to me. Yesterday was the best day I have seen for 3 months." By the end of the summer, he had gained 15 pounds, fresh color was restored to his face, and he resumed a more normal schedule. On February 23, 1892, he had Gates post a letter to the University of Chicago trustees, pledging another $1 million, with these words, "I make this gift as a thank offering to Almighty God for returning health." In fact, the offering was as much a grudging response to Harper's improvident spending as a token of Rockefeller's gratitude to the Lord. Having always enjoyed ruddy health, Rockefeller was evidently shaken by his lengthy illness, for he dreaded rushing back to work and precipitating a relapse. He now contemplated something inconceivable for most other restless tycoons of the period, retirement. He had no psychological need to spend his life amassing money, and told Gates that he had all he wanted. As he later explained, "I felt that at 50 it was due me to have freedom from absorption in active business affairs, and to devote myself to a variety of interests other than money-making, which had claimed a portion of my time since the beginning of my business career." Though he craved retirement, several crises tethered him to business for another 3 or 4 years, until he stopped going to 26 Broadway altogether in 1897. In the meantime, he reported to the office less and less, as the focus of his life shifted slowly from earning money to dispensing it as intelligently as possible. Although Harper had the founder's promise that he would attend opening ceremonies, Rockefeller, eager to prove that he would not meddle with the school, later rejected the idea. One also suspects that he subtly wished to telegraph his displeasure to Harper over the handling of university finances. In early 1892, Gates visited Chicago and was utterly appalled at the yawning chasm between Harper's extravagant schemes and the available money. Yet with all his open-handed spending, Harper had accomplished one of the great feats in educational history. True to his wishes, he opened the school on October 1, 1892, without ceremony, as if it were the continuation of a work which has been conducted for 1,000 years. His hastily gathered faculty was so studded with renowned scholars that the university was catapulted instantly into the front ranks of higher education. On the first day of classes, the new school boasted 750 students, one-fourth of them women, 10 Jewish students, 8 Catholics, and a handful of blacks. Architect Henry Ives Cobb had little more than a year to summon a campus into being, and 5 major buildings were completed in 1892, another 5 in 1893. Built at a moment of civic pride, the new university sprang up beside the fabled White City of the 1893 Columbian Exposition. The fairgrounds featured a spectacular Standard Oil exhibit of a miniature refinery surrounded by a strange colonnade of Ionic columns with alternating oil-filled lamps and vases. From a Ferris wheel on the midway, visitors received a superb aerial view of the new school that Standard Oil profits had produced. Since Henry Ives Cobb also helped to plan the fairgrounds, the two projects appeared to blend into a seamless whole. Once the university was inaugurated, President Harper did not stand still. Impulsive, never satisfied, he began to advance on 100 fronts. Heedless of costs, he broached new initiatives to create a junior college, a night school, a correspondence school, extension courses for adults, a university press, a special division for laboratories, and museums. As leader of this educational trust, he wanted to dispatch scholars to teach at affiliated colleges in other states, an expensive initiative vetoed by Rockefeller. Harper also believed a university should benefit the surrounding city, and sociologists fanned out from the campus to undertake studies at Hull House and other settlement houses. For all his pride in the university, Rockefeller dreaded this unbridled growth, which postponed the day when the new university might survive without him. Often, when Harper bagged another famous scholar, the university had to buy equipment for the newcomer, money Harper neglected to figure into his calculations. For all their mutual attraction, Rockefeller and Harper were destined to clash. As Gates framed the contrast, Mr. Rockefeller, with a breadth of vision as great as Dr. Harper's, was temperamentally cool, reserved, cautious, circumspect, deliberate, amazingly patient, but in the end inflexible, adapting means to ends with long and accurate prevision. Dr. Harper was ardent, highly imaginative, with limitless capacity and insatiable eagerness for work, an undaunted optimist, minimizing difficulties, magnifying opportunities, rapid in conception, confiding, unsuspicious, bent on immediate results, willful, and impatient of opposition or delay. As a businessman, Rockefeller believed in praying for good times while bracing for bad, and his recurring pleas for caution were vindicated in 1893 when panic seized the American economy and the university had to stall on paying salaries. To surmount the crisis, Rockefeller transferred another $500,000 to the university that October. He was now drawn in so deep that he couldn't withdraw, and Harper knew it. Having sworn he would never cover operating deficits, Rockefeller had to renounce that policy and cover the budget shortfall for the next 2 years. What made it so hard to enforce discipline in Chicago was that after the obligatory protest, Rockefeller always came through with the money. In October 1895, Gates went to Chicago armed with a letter from Rockefeller pledging another $3 million for the school's endowment, possibly the largest such sum ever given at one time by one man for educational purposes, and worth about $50 million today. Soon after, Harper and the university secretary, Thomas W. Goodspeed, attended a football game between Chicago and Wisconsin. During the first half, they told coach Amos Alonzo Stagg, who set up the first department of physical culture at an American university, about the gift. With Chicago trailing 12-10 at halftime, Stagg suggested that the team be informed, because I felt it would be a strong piece of psychology to do so, as he said. When told by Harper of the gift in the locker room, the team's captain roared, $3 million, and gave another player a gleeful slap on the back. Just watch us play football. With that, the born-again squad streamed back onto the field and beat Wisconsin 22-12. Later on, students lit a huge celebratory bonfire on campus and sang hymns to Rockefeller, including one that began, "There was a man sent from God whose name was John." Despite a standing offer to tour his creation, Rockefeller declined to visit Chicago for several years, reluctant to have the university overly identified with his name. As Gates told Harper, "There are, as you know, advantages to the university, advantages in your canvas for funds, in the disinterested way in which Mr. Rockefeller has given his money." Beyond that, Rockefeller cherished his privacy and hated public occasions. When Harper finally persuaded John and Seti to attend the first-class quinquennial celebration in July 1897, he promised that Rockefeller would not need to speak. The patron's ideal was to amble unseen through the campus for a couple of hours, an anonymous voyeur relishing his creation. As hundreds of students and professors, clad in caps and gowns, trooped into a huge tent in the central quadrangle on a sweltering July day, only one figure wore a plain frock coat and silk hat, the university founder, who marched, as he had since boyhood, with his eyes fixed on the ground. Far from being a fire-breathing mogul, he seemed quiet and faintly embarrassed by the fuss being made over him. When he got up on stage, 3,000 people gazed in fascination at this reclusive American legend who had mesmerized the public as both a sinner and saint. It was so stifling inside the tent that hundreds of palm leaf fans undulated in the audience. When Harper rose and reviewed the future needs of the university, he turned expectantly toward Rockefeller and referred to the pressing need for a hall to replace this temporary tent, eliciting an ambiguous smile from Rockefeller, who must have squirmed in his seat. Then the Titan rose to address the crowd. "I want to thank your board of trustees, your president, and all who have shared in this most wonderful beginning. It is but a beginning," he was interrupted by frenzied applause, "and you will do the rest." The audience quieted down. "You have the privilege to complete it, you and your sons and your daughters. I believe in the work. It is the best investment I ever made in my life. Why shouldn't people give to the University of Chicago money, time, their best efforts? Why not? It is the grandest opportunity ever presented. Where were gathered ever a better board of trustees, a better faculty? I am profoundly, profoundly thankful that I had anything to do with this affair." A roar of appreciative laughter. "The good Lord gave me the money, and how could I withhold it from Chicago?" Whatever his own discomfort, Rockefeller made an excellent impression. Before the day was out, he had laid cornerstones, listened to sermons, and given two more short talks. He spent the night at Harper's house and was so unnerved by the absence of clocks, the visit made him deviate from his usual daily schedule, that he gave Mrs. Harper $1,000 check as a gift and suggested she buy clocks. The next morning, Rockefeller mounted a bike and set off on a campus tour with university administrators in tow. Attired in a bicycle suit, he set off at a brisk pace, waving at cheering students along the route. The entourage flew down the midway to Jackson Park, circled the ghostly remains of the Columbian Exposition, stopped for refreshments, then whirled back down the midway. Rockefeller was enormously gratified and touched by the warm, spontaneous enthusiasm of the students. Everywhere he went, they chanted, "John D. Rockefeller, wonderful man as he, gives all his spare change to the U of C." Another knot of students burst into a fight song. "Who's the feller? Who's the feller? Rah, rah, rah. Rockefeller, he's the feller. Sis, boom, ba." As a philanthropist, Rockefeller chose to cultivate a wise detachment from his creations and told Harper that he saw himself as a silent partner in the operation. Despite intermittent accusations to the contrary, he did not interfere with academic appointments or free expression, though sometimes tempted to do so. When several Chicago students denounced his monopolistic practices, an enraged Rockefeller complained to Gates of statements from the students, derogatory to the founder, careless and inexcusable. But whether the report is correct, I do not know. It seemed to me, if it was correct, the men should be expelled from the Chicago University. In this and other cases, as best as one can tell, Rockefeller then countermanded the order, fearing the threat to academic freedom, or at least to his own reputation. It took courage to start a university in the 1890s, when academes swarmed with vocal critics of big business, and many of Rockefeller's industrialist friends saw universities as so many breeding grounds for subversion. William chided his brother for sponsoring the school. "You are getting together a lot of scribblers, a crowd of socialists who won't do any good." Rockefeller wrestled with the issue, but believed on balance that while scribblers of the worthless kind brought poison with their ink to the minds of the people, yet multitudes of others come out of these institutions of learning to strengthen the good among us. Let us hope so. The University of Chicago was scarcely immune to the radical currents on campus. In 1899, while at Chicago, Thorsten Veblen published The Theory of the Leisure Class, which portrayed the new captains of industry as brutal troglodytes and exposed the primitive impulses lurking behind their gaudy consumption habits. The best publicized controversy about Rockefeller's role at Chicago involved the dismissal in 1895 of a young political economist, Edward Bemis, who advocated municipal gas ownership and attacked the Standard Oil-controlled United Gas Improvement Company. The official explanation for the firing was that Bemis was more an activist than a scholar and did not measure up to the university's high standards. Since Bemis had been hired by Harper himself and went on to a career of some distinction in utility regulation, one suspects a political motive behind his dismissal, yet there is no evidence that Rockefeller was the culprit. It seems more likely that Harper sacked him in anticipation of Rockefeller's wrath. A year earlier, Harper had warned Bemis about his political activities after he made an inflammatory speech criticizing the railroad's behavior during the Pullman strike. Such visible activism handicapped Harper in courting local business, as he made clear in a letter to Bemis in July 1894. "Your speech at the First Presbyterian Church has caused me a great deal of annoyance. It is hardly safe for me to venture into any of the Chicago clubs. I am pounced upon from all sides. I propose that during the remainder of your connection with the university, you exercise great care in public utterances about questions that are agitating the minds of the people." Rockefeller refrained from such pressure because he knew the political value of his nonpartisan patronage of a university at a time when he was being accused of subverting other institutions to advance his own interests. Rockefeller did, however, request a voice in fiscal matters, the one thing that Harper denied him. Like many donors, Rockefeller wished to give freely, but Harper was constantly trying to speed up the process. In appointing Gates as his buffer with Harper, Rockefeller hoped to keep the university guessing about future gifts, but the tactic did not work. "Harper was insatiable in his appetite for money," said one Standard Oil counsel. "Gates was the guardian of the treasurer." As time passed, the strains between Gates and Harper grew intolerable. Both men were idealists, steeped in religion, marred by a streak of worldly ambition, and each accused the other of hypocritically exploiting Rockefeller for personal gain. At first, Gates admired Harper as an inspirational figure who overspent out of naive enthusiasm. He later modified this sanguine view when Harper stoutly denied that a first-rate university could be run as an efficient business, and declared, "A university that is properly operated always has a deficit." When this remark appeared in the press, it grated on Rockefeller and Gates as rank betrayal. According to Gates, Harper flouted several clear understandings with Rockefeller, that the university would never be indebted, would never use endowment funds for university buildings, and would never form an alliance with any medical college in Chicago. When Gates put these points in writing and asked Harper to circulate them to board members, they mysteriously disappeared. When he remonstrated with Harper for hiring more expensive professors and launching new journals, the university president simply ignored him. Soon after Gates insisted that he forego new buildings, Harper appealed to Chicago's citizens to support a new building campaign. Just as Rockefeller feared, Harper had rashly leaped straight from a small college to a big university. As Harper rolled up deficits, his patron kept adding millions to the endowment, but he could only be pushed so far. As legions of business rivals had learned, he sometimes groped toward a solution, then acted in a swift, decisive manner. "I warned Dr. Harper," Gates said. "I warned him many times. I warned him in words, in deed, and in every possible way." Sometimes, when Harper journeyed to New York, Gates thought the president had learned the error of his ways. Then Harper returned to Chicago and relapsed into free-spending habits. After years of fruitless wrangling, the university was still struggling with a deficit of $200,000 in early 1897, when Rockefeller decided he had had enough. Bypassing Harper, he summoned two representatives from Chicago, Goodspeed and Henry Rust, to meet with Gates and Jr. Rockefeller himself did not attend these meetings, leaving these negotiations to his proxies. On this historic occasion, Gates expressed Rockefeller's disappointment at Harper's failure to raise money from outside sources to reduce the deficit. As Gates pointed out, Rockefeller believed that nonprofit institutions should be even more circumspect with money than business organizations. Rockefeller feels that an institution of learning should be far more conservatively managed than, for instance, a bank, or even a savings bank or a trust company. These companies need only assure the depositor or investor that his funds will be duly cared for during the limited time in which they may be deposited. But a university invests the funds of those who are seeking to make an investment of money for the good of humanity, which shall last, if possible, as long as the world stands. Like Dr. Augustus H. Strong before him, Harper had fundamentally miscalculated in approaching Rockefeller for money. Gates noted that Rockefeller had long ago planned to found a great university and had ample resources to do so. It was the cavalier, high-handed way that Harper dunned him for money that rankled. Mr. Rockefeller comes instinctively to feel that the methods of securing his assistance are too often methods of compulsion, said Gates. The appeals come to him in the shape almost of forced contributions. Though the meeting ended with Gates acknowledging Harper's accomplishments, he had delivered a humiliating rebuke to his leadership. After reading a stenographic transcript of the meeting, Rockefeller asked that every university board member read it and took the unusual step of having it deposited in his safe as a personal testament of his future wishes for the school. 2 months later, the University of Chicago trustees instituted drastic changes. Henceforth, Rockefeller would be notified of new expenditures and given a chance to protest. Gates had joined the board the year before, and Junior followed a year later, giving John D. direct representation in the university's management. The breach that had opened up between the university's patron saint and its charismatic president was distressing to both men, who had enjoyed an intimate father-son relationship. Now proscribed from asking Rockefeller for more money, Harper forfeited the easy access he had long cherished. For the emotional Harper, prone to both wild elation and inconsolable gloom, it was hard to be muzzled in his patron's presence. According to legend, when prohibited from talking about money directly to Rockefeller, Harper circumvented the ban by praying aloud for money in his presence. The story, if true, suggests that he still had not absorbed the lesson that Rockefeller had reluctantly and repeatedly tried to teach him. Chapter 18. Nemesis. Even as Rockefeller tried to shift his attention away from business in the 1890s, the political backlash against him gained fresh momentum, making it impossible for him to sever himself from his brilliant but tarnished record. As he tried to move ahead, his past loomed ever larger in the public imagination. During the next 20 years, it kept returning to haunt him, like an inescapable shadow. The Sherman Antitrust Act had proved an ineffectual piece of legislation. The real threat to Standard Oil arose in an improbable spot: a small bookstore in Columbus, Ohio. In 1889, the state's young Republican Attorney General, David K. Watson, wandered into the shop one evening and happened upon a slim volume by William W. Cook, cheaply bound in imitation leather and bearing the title Trusts, The Recent Combinations in Trade. He took the book home and perused it late into the night. In the appendix, Watson was fascinated to discover Standard Oil's trust deed, which he had never seen before. He was aghast to learn that for the past 7 years, Standard Oil of Ohio had violated its state charter by transferring control of the organization to mostly out-of-state trustees in New York. Capitalizing on this discovery, Watson filed a quo warranto petition against Ohio Standard in the state Supreme Court in May 1890, seeking nothing less than the dissolution of Standard Oil. Standard Oil executives reacted, as always, by denigrating such measures as transparent harassment by their business enemies. Frank sent a letter to John saying that he was not sure as to who the instigators are, but believe Cleveland refiners have a hand in it, and conjectured that Watson was feeding off information from John Sherman. In rebutting the charges, Standard's attorney, Samuel C.T. Dodd, offered the same legal fig leaf that the Combine had exploited for years: that Ohio Standard shares had been transferred by individual stockholders, not the company itself, to its New York trustees. By now, the ruse was wearing thin. Ironically, this sortie against Standard Oil came in a conservative industrial state, where its influence was pervasive. As a rock-ribbed Republican contributor, Rockefeller felt betrayed by such ingratitude and protested to a Cleveland friend that, "We have not received fair treatment from the Republican Party." Never one to mince words, Mark Hanna, the party kingpin, sent a strongly worded message to Watson, telling him that the Standard Oil Company is officered and managed by some of the best and strongest men in the country. They are pretty much all Republicans and have been most liberal in their contributions to the party, as I personally know. Mr. Rockefeller always quietly doing his share. Although Hanna urged him to drop the suit, Watson would not relent. While Rockefeller blandly denied knowledge of Hanna's action, his memory was conveniently faulty, for on April 7, 1891, Hanna had written to him, "I caught our distinguished Attorney General Watson here the other day and gave him a piece of my mind." Watson's successor, Frank Manette, alleged that on 6 occasions, Watson was offered bribes to terminate the case, in one instance as much as $100,000 in cash. But Manette never provided corroborating evidence, perhaps fearing Standard Oil reprisals against his sources. Such intimidation, if it did occur, only stiffened Watson's resistance to pressure. On March 2, 1892, he won a famous victory when the Ohio Supreme Court ruled that Standard Oil of Ohio was indeed controlled by trustees at 26 Broadway, and had to renounce the trust agreement. The trust was also accused of trying to monopolize every phase of the petroleum business. One enterprising reporter who rushed to 26 Broadway was assured that the decision would in no way affect the trust. When a reporter showed up on Samuel Dodd's doorstep, the Standard Counsel was a model of urbanity. "The trust agreements were not really necessary," he said. "They were simply made as a matter of conscience. The only effect of the decision will be to inconvenience us a little." This insouciance was only partly studied. In responding to legal challenges, the Combine had reconstituted itself many times, like some mythical protean creature that could metamorphose into infinite shapes to elude lawmakers. For several years, Dodd and Rockefeller had studied possible responses in case the trust had to be dissolved in an antitrust suit. They had taken note of an 1889 New Jersey law that permitted corporations resident in the state to hold stock in other corporations. This revolutionary development opened the possibility of forming holding companies that could operate nationwide and provide a critical escape hatch for embattled trusts. As a result, Standard Oil calmly greeted the 1892 Ohio decision less as a mortal threat than an opportunity for a long-overdue reorganization. For several days, Standard executives tried to figure out how best to comply with the ruling. Their minds were focused by the knowledge that if they didn't act, the New York Attorney General was poised to file antitrust papers. On March 10, 1892, 1 week after the Ohio decision, Samuel Dodd announced that the trust would be dissolved. The next day, a mailing went out to all holders of Standard Oil trust certificates, summoning them to a March 21st meeting and inviting them to exchange their certificates for proportionate shares of 20 constituent companies. The distribution of power, money, and dividends within the Standard Oil empire would remain exactly the same, a deft maneuver that would be copied by other corporations harried by antitrust laws. As the holder of 256,854 of 972,500 outstanding shares of the Standard Oil Trust, John D. Rockefeller chaired the March 21st meeting. Even though 300 people were jammed into a room designed to hold only 200, the stage-managed event was brief and businesslike. The unanimous vote to dissolve the trust was a foregone conclusion. Though designated one of 8 liquidating trustees, Rockefeller had just recuperated from the breakdown in his health and wanted to transfer the burden of reorganization to his colleagues. He was spared a terrible ordeal since the liquidation proved highly contentious. Small shareholders balked at trading in trust certificates for fractional shares that paid no dividends and could not be redeemed in any secondary market. In the eyes of Standard's detractors, the exchange dragged on for a suspiciously long time. Aided by changes in New Jersey's incorporation law, Standard Oil of New Jersey took on a unique status in the transformed company. Renamed Standard Oil, New Jersey, it bought in whole or in part huge blocks of stock in the other Standard companies, and thus legally held stock in properties from coast to coast, functioning as both an operating and holding company. Standard of New York also attained new status in a reorganization that initiated the 7-year period of the so-called Standard Oil interests. The 1892 overhaul was mostly shadow play, a charade to appease the courts. The executive committee at 26 Broadway was formally dissolved, but the members lost only their titles and were soon converted by the nicest legal cunning into the presidents of 20 affiliated companies. In Standard parlance, these men were now the gentlemen upstairs, or the gentlemen in room 1400. Nobody had to switch seats at the lunch table, and Rockefeller and his coterie ruled as absolutely as before. 17 individual stockholders, almost all Standard Oil executives or family members, controlled a majority of stock in the 20 companies and elected their directors. This legal ledger domain again frustrated lawmakers who felt that the combine was so vast, slippery, and elusive that it could never be tamed or held accountable. Standard Oil executives saw the major threat to the company in 1892 as the aging of their leadership. The organization was still piloted by the same sturdy souls who had steered it since the 1870s, and were now beginning to die off or retire. The alarm bells must have sounded when Rockefeller sought retirement, a decision postponed temporarily by the economic crisis of 1893. The panic showed him functioning less as a Standard Oil executive than as a sovereign power, endowed with resources rivaling those of government. He continued, however, to operate in the shadows, a spectral figure whose presence was mostly felt, not seen. The depression heralded by the June 1893 stock market crash was one of such excruciating length, such grinding and unrelieved misery, that economic historians labeled it the Great Depression, until that title was usurped in the 1930s. During the troubled summer of 1893, the Erie and Northern Pacific Railroads failed, followed by many others bloated with debt and riddled with fraud. Mass unemployment across the nation sharpened class tensions. During the sanguinary clash a year earlier at the Homestead, Pennsylvania steel mill, Henry Clay Frick had ordered Pinkerton detectives to fire at workers, a step that drew a rousing congratulatory telegram from John Dee. Such corporate truculence provoked calls by the new Populist Party for a graduated income tax, government ownership of railroad and telegraph companies, and tougher safeguards for trade unions. Rockefeller stood high on the list of bogeymen regularly berated by populists, and legend has it that he began to sleep with a revolver by his bed. As the country grew more polarized, many people wondered whether America had paid too dear a price for the industrialization that had so quickly propelled it from an agrarian society to a world economic power. By early 1894, the slump had toppled 600 shaky banks, and an almost palpable threat of insurrection hovered in the air, prompting financial writer Alexander Dana Noyes to observe that there were periods when industrial unrest seemed to assume the proportions of anarchy. In the spring of 1894, General Jacob Coxey of Ohio led his bedraggled Army of the Commonwealth of Christ in a doomed march on Washington to entreat Congress for legislative relief. 2 months later, workers at the Pullman Palace Car Company struck to reverse massive layoffs and wage cuts, triggering a sympathy strike by the American Railway Union under Eugene V. Debs. When President Cleveland sent troops to Chicago, Debs was jailed, and 7 strikers were gunned down. All the pent-up frustrations produced by the accelerated change of the late 19th century were vented in spontaneous, often violent dissent. To the dismay of critics, Standard Oil and other trusts fared quite well during the prolonged downturn. Demand for illuminating oil and lubricants, now necessities of life, remained healthy, leading Standard Oil to prosper amid the general austerity. Meanwhile, a new source of future profits beckoned in the middle distance. In the early 1880s, Gottlieb Daimler strapped light gasoline engines onto bicycles, tricycles, and other vehicles, experiments that culminated in the motor car, while another German inventor, Carl Benz, patented a 3-wheeled automobile with a single-cylinder engine in 1886. In 1892, the Duryea brothers were tinkering with their first automobile. Recognizing a fantastic market in the offing, Standard Oil sent a representative to attend the test of a new gasoline engine for a streetcar motor. The next year, Henry Ford tested a 2-cylinder auto that sped along at 30 miles an hour, resuscitating fears that existing oil supplies might fall short of needs, an anxiety somewhat assuaged by oil discoveries in Los Angeles and elsewhere in California in the 1890s. So remarkable was this West Coast boom that it soon furnished more oil than the old Pennsylvania and Ohio fields that had formed the basis of Rockefeller's wealth. The advent of the automobile was a godsend for Standard Oil, for the more light bulbs shone across America, the more kerosene was relegated to remote rural areas without access to electric power. Standard Oil again benefited from hard times to extend its powerful reach. For several years, the trust had watched the exploits of Pittsburgh's Mellon family with apprehension, and Archbold was under strict orders from Rockefeller to grab any of their oil properties that came on the market. As the Mellons emerged as a worrisome threat in the export market, Rockefeller feared they might strike an alliance with the French Rothschilds. In August 1895, having borrowed heavily against Pittsburgh real estate to build their budding oil empire, the Mellons were forced to sell their Crescent Pipeline Company and other properties to Standard, a huge windfall that yielded 14,000 acres and 135 producing wells. It now seemed that Standard Oil owned the entire industry, lock, stock, and barrel. When the Geodetic Association announced plans to measure the earth, the world opined that the information would enable the Standard Oil Trust and other trusts to learn the exact size of their property. Soon thereafter, to everyone's amazement, the Independents, after so many hapless drubbings, rallied one last time and made a successful run at the trust. Through a new company, the Producers and Refiners Oil Company, 1,000 well owners agreed to supply crude oil to 15 independent refineries, linked by a new network of local pipelines. In the fall of 1892, that perennial standard scourge, Lewis Emery Jr., had organized United States Pipeline, which now promised to give the rebels a vital pipeline to the seaboard. To lay the pipe, Emery's men had to ward off savage harassment from the railroads. Locomotives would roar by and douse them with scalding steam, boiling water, and glowing coals. Despite these obstructive tactics, independent oil began to flow in 1893. Shifting tactics, the trust then engineered a steep decline in kerosene prices. No mean trick in a period of rising crude prices. Squeezed by dwindling profit margins, three large independent refineries finally submitted to the trust's suzerainty, but the Producers and Refiners Oil Company miraculously survived. In 1895, emboldened by a new sense of Rockefeller's vulnerability, 30 independent refiners coalesced into the Pure Oil Company, the first enduring domestic competitor of Standard Oil. To preserve their autonomy, they sequestered half their voting stock in the hands of five men eternally sworn to keep it free of Standard influence. Thus, several years before federal trustbusters mobilized to smash the Rockefeller monopoly, serious competition had already taken root in the marketplace. Despite this setback, Rockefeller was not hurting in the 1890s. There was now a self-perpetuating quality to his wealth. Whether he was gardening, eating, or just lying in bed, his prolific savings quietly grew around the clock. He was receiving about $3 million yearly in Standard Oil dividends, more than $50 million in 1996 dollars, and redirecting them into a vast portfolio of outside investments that made him a one-man holding company, with $24 million now invested outside the oil and gas business. He held sizable stakes in 16 railroad companies, 9 real estate firms, 6 steel companies, 6 steamship companies, 9 banks and financial houses, and even 2 orange groves. The oil trust's resilience during the Depression of the 1890s, its tested immunity from market fluctuations, cheered Rockefeller, who attributed this to Standard's large cash reserves and conservative dividend policy. The panic seemed to offer irrefutable proof to Rockefeller that cooperation was superior to the vagaries of cutthroat competition. It certainly allowed him the luxury of a benevolent paternalism at a time of labor strife in other industries. "We held things together so steady that our fortunate laboring men got their pay, though in other concerns many of them were compelled to go and without bread," he later told William O. Inglis. "It was a matter of congratulation with us that we could look into the happy faces of our workmen in these perilous times and hand them the wages they had earned." Since the early 1880s, Standard Oil had been self-financing, very liquid at all times, and free from the thrall of Wall Street bankers. As a result, no other industrial corporation was so fearless or independent. It was one of Rockefeller's proudest boasts that, unlike other trusts, he had not needed a J.P. Morgan to forge his combine. Standard Oil anticipated a major feature of the 20th century economy: the tendency of sophisticated, cash-rich corporations to outgrow their traditional bankers and become financial service giants in their own rights. As journalist John Moody perceptively wrote, "The Standard Oil Trust was really a bank of the most gigantic character, a bank within an industry, financing this industry against all competition and continually lending vast sums of money to needy borrowers on high-class collateral, just as the other great banks were doing." It was Standard Oil of New York that functioned as the main banker for the affiliated companies, governing what was arguably the most stupendous cash flow ever produced in American industry. To maximize its leverage over Wall Street, it scattered its gigantic balances among many banks, A single Standard Oil entity, the National Transit Company, sometimes kept as much as $40 million on deposit. Standard Oil of New York also made large loans to banks, brokerage houses, railroads, and steel companies. So rich in cash, Standard Oil wielded a make-or-break power over Wall Street houses, which defied it at their peril. Standard directors often took out prodigious loans from the trust. On the eve of the 1893 panic, John D. had a $1.36 million loan outstanding, while Brother William owed $865,000. As president of New York Standard, William Rockefeller parlayed his position into one of exceptional prominence on Wall Street. For John, the street might be a sinful haunt, but it had its own sulphurous charms for William. In 1884, while they both served as directors of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad, William had met James Stillman, the youngest director of National City Bank. In an inspired move, Stillman recruited William as a director. By the time Stillman became the bank's president in 1891, National City had been so enriched by the Standard Oil bounty that it was nicknamed the Oil Bank. When the 1893 panic struck, John D. was just emerging from the seclusion occasioned by his medical problems. He raced back to New York from Cleveland to orchestrate a massive salvage operation. In the course of the panic, he provided almost $6 million to 58 individuals and firms who were turned down by banks and desperately needed his intervention. To bail out these borrowers, Rockefeller had to borrow almost $4 million, and nearly $3 million of that came from Standard of New York. This was a tricky balancing act, since he was borrowing on the collateral of securities then collapsing in value. In October 1893, the Standard Oil treasurer, William T. Wardwell, having decided that Rockefeller had reached the permissible limit, did the unthinkable. He shut down the lending window on the company founder. A stupefied George Rogers relayed this verdict to his boss. "He has refused to give me any more money because he had no assurance of getting it back when he wanted." After frantic negotiations, Wardwell boosted Rockefeller's credit line to $2.8 million in exchange for a lien on his quarterly dividend of $775,000 from Standard Oil stock. Some of Rockefeller's letters reflect tragicomic confusion as he struggled to collect loans from debtors in order to pay off his own debt to Standard Oil. In early September, he wrote to Setti from New York that he had settled his debts with $550,000 to spare. "We are steadily emerging from the panic, but I hope never to go through with another such experience." When it came to old friends, his generosity could be dazzling. When Captain Vandergrift telegraphed from Pittsburgh that a trust company he directed stood in mortal peril, Rockefeller telegraphed promptly, "How much do you want?" $1 million, came the response, to which Rockefeller replied, "Check for $1 million is on the way." But he was so inundated with pleas that many more people were spurned than saved, generating unavoidable bitterness. Frederick T. Gates referred to these painful quandaries in an October 1893 letter. "I have today on my desk urgent imperative appeals to save old friends of Mr. Rockefeller's, amounting to many hundreds of thousands of dollars. I have incurred the enmity of many important business enterprises because I have had to decline to assist them in the last few days." More than one person who was refused later accused Rockefeller of having ruined him. During the panic, Rockefeller awakened to the public responsibilities attending great wealth. Having long been reflexively hostile to government, he now found himself cooperating with Washington to calm the jitters in financial markets. In 1894, the U.S. Treasury, alarmed by the outflow of gold that legally backed the gold standard, turned to J.P. Morgan for a rescue operation. After telling John G. Carlyle, the Treasury Secretary, that this was impossible, Morgan conferred hastily with Stillman, a measure of Stillman's new stature on Wall Street. "He was greatly upset and overcharged," recalled Stillman. "Nearly wept, put his head in his hands, and cried, 'They expect the impossible.' So I calmed him down and told him to give me an hour, and by that time I cabled for 10 million from Europe for the Standard Oil, and 10 more from other resources. When Stillman walked into Morgan's office to report the $20 million, Morgan grew giddy and triumphant. He took the pose of savior of his country and assumed all the credit, Stillman observed archly, crediting the real success to himself and Standard Oil. But then you see he is a poet. Morgan is a poet. Rockefeller never claimed credit for his action and preferred no publicity. Stillman's behavior during the panic had a deleterious effect on his relationship with Rockefeller, who had given him $5 million amid multiple demands. Rockefeller believed that the crafty Stillman had not only held his money longer than necessary, but employed it to buy stocks at bargain prices instead of using it to shore up his bank. Under any circumstance, Rockefeller would have been critical of an alliance between Standard Oil and a Wall Street bank, but after the 1893 panic, his disenchantment with Stillman gave him extra misgivings about Williams' policy of placing large balances in his